Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
I hope you're sitting down for this. George Barna's Cultural Research Center found only 13% of born-again Christians have a biblical worldview. That means there's a huge lack of biblical life essentials in our country. AFA is committed to helping churches ignite a hunger for God. You can be part of that with your gift today, and we'll send you Dr. Alex McFarland's DVD, Do Christians Have Permission to Edit Scripture? Visit afa.net/biblical. afa.net/biblical.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Monday, November 17th, and the government is open, and people are, I think, a little bit mixed on that front. I mean, overall, of course, we're happy about it, and yet, for regular listeners who have heard my consistent rants on this point, I'm very disappointed in the Republican Congress for not simply doing their job, actually wanting to govern and reopening the government, not only on their terms, but also without letting it go on 40 plus days. But, you know, the government is reopened now. And according to the Department of Transportation, the FAA, normal flights and all of that will resume within a week. And so we're kind of getting things back a little bit to where they should be. But what does this actually mean moving forward? Because we are in the position of, now that this is November, looking ahead to midterms, and Congress really has done absolutely nothing in terms of codifying Trump's executive orders, in terms of legislating things for the future that, who knows, there may be a Democrat president in 2028. Stranger things have happened. We know we can pray that the Lord would give us a further reprieve, but he did in 2024. And have we really taken advantage of that? I think that we, the Christian conservatives, have wanted that, but does our party, which is, of course, largely the Republicans, have they really taken advantage of this moment and this time? We're almost a year into Trump's presidency. What do we have to show for it other than what he has done in the executive? I don't see the promises being kept from Congress. And they are acting really similarly to how they did in Trump's first term when Paul Ryan was Speaker of the House and he was intentionally thwarting Trump's agenda. And that was the last time that we had the trifecta. And we could have gotten so much more done between 2017 through the midterms. And if anybody remembers, we lost the midterms. And that's what gave rise to all of the beginning of the lawfare against President Trump, against what turned into targeting Christians and conservatives under then the Biden DOJ. I mean, all of that. We really missed our moment. So what is going on in Washington? Well, joining me now to continue this rant is one of my favorite people to rant with, who is, of course, Mike Donnelly, who is an attorney, and he teaches law classes and just is an overall amazing pontificator, I should say it that way, but from a Christian biblical worldview perspective. So that's why I like having him on the show. So Mike, from your perspective, you've been around Congress, you've been around Washington, and in fact, you know, way longer than me. And I still remember when I was first going to Washington, because you and I had already known each other years by then. You were very disillusioned with Washington. I was the very starry-eyed, like, yeah, I'm going to go in and, you know, make a difference. And this is, you know, the seat of American government and the founders and all the, you know, wonderful things, of course. But I think that you are rightly disillusioned, and over the last decade of Trump world and all of that that I've been involved in, I've been similarly, unfortunately, disillusioned. So on that note, because you even have far more experience in D.C. Than I do, what is your perspective of what is wrong with Congress?
Wow, Jenna, people have written books on that. Good morning, everyone. Good morning to you. And it's a great day to live in America. This is the best country in the world, and we should be very thankful for what we have in spite of the best efforts of our federal government to get in the way of freedom and democracy and, us running our lives, which, you know, this is the thing about humanity. We're fallen, Jenna. And, you know, when you say that I was disillusioned, I think I was just being realistic about human nature back in 2016, 2018. And, you know, I think things are very different between 2016 and now when we look at the midterms. But I think what we need to remember as believers is that the heart of the king is like a river in the hands of God. I think Proverbs talks about that. And ultimately, God's purposes will prevail. And we are just called to be faithful where we are and do the things in front of us, whether that's raising our children, going to work, affecting the things that we can affect. And for those who are called to lead, they're called to a higher standard. You know, we look at the qualifications in, Timothy for those who would lead the church. And, you know, I think that's part of the problem we have in our country is we're not holding our leaders to the standards that we should. I see some good leaders, but I think we've lost the bubble, if you will, on that. You know, if a person isn't fit to lead the church, why should they be fit to lead our country? We've kind of flipped things around a little bit. But when you think about, okay, what's going to happen in Congress, I think that's part of the problem. You know, our founders did not design our country for us to have 24/7 media cycles about what's happening in Washington, D.C. They thought and wanted the seat of government to be in the home and, you know, in the towns and the counties and the states. And we've had a complete reversal of that. And, you know, we've talked about that over the years. I think that's the big problem. I'd love to see Congress do something about that. But the problem is so much has happened over the last 100 years that has resulted in us getting to where we are. I don't foresee that happening in a very revolutionary fashion. So we're left with what we've got. We've got $38 trillion in debt. We've got a highly bureaucratized federal government that gets in the way. And we've got 535 individuals arguing about how to cut up, you know, what is it? I don't know, $4, $5, $6, $7, $8 trillion that they're taking from us every year. Not what's the recipe for success? I think the recipe for success is make Washington less significant. Okay. I think let's focus on the states. What can the states do? The states need to become self-sufficient. We need to make sure that we're electing governors and leaders in our capitals who can stop taking money from Washington, D.C., stop being dependent on Washington, D.C., so that they can do things that will make the lives of the American people in their states better. I would point to your state and your governor. Ron DeSantis has a great idea. You know, why should we have to pay property taxes just to live in our homes? He frames it so well. I love what he's doing and what he's saying. And I hope other governors and other people around the country will listen to what Ron DeSantis is saying in that regard. I think that's a great idea. It's a great point. So I've ranted for a little bit. You go ahead, direct the conversation where you want to go.
Well, you know, because yes, of course, because we can continue to rant about all things, and it's not a small solution. And so to suggest that, you know, even in a 1 hour broadcast here, and we don't even have that much time with you, Mike Donnelly, that we can, you know, solve all the world's problems in America, you know, in just one quick fell swoop. But I think you touched on something that's incredibly important, which is this idea of federalism. And when you were saying that you were just, you're not necessarily disillusioned, it's just looking at things in the lens of reality. That's what our founders did. And, you know, it reminded me of the Federalist Papers and talking about, you know, that government is necessary until men are angels. This isn't going to be a perfect system, but we can look at a perfect God and his authority and view what a legitimate government should be doing. And we've gotten so far astray from that. And so, you know, returning to federalism, all of these very unfortunately lofty goals, I mean, this should be commonplace. Those are things that things like the Convention of States Project are trying to implement, things that conservatives over the long haul have consistently pushed. But I do want to focus just on what Congress, even though, yes, we shouldn't necessarily have the 24/7 news cycle about what's going on in D.C. and people know more what's going on in on the federal news cycle in the Fox News circuit than they do in their own backyard, which is problematic. But at the same time, in the short term and in this moment of the year that we have left before the midterms, there actually is a lot that Congress can and should do legitimately. And that's what I'm the most frustrated with and don't understand, because Speaker Johnson is not Paul Ryan. And Leader Thune is, you know, not a contrarian opposition, you know, Trump hater. And so why aren't they doing the very bare minimum basics, like repealing the FACE Act, for example, like codifying Trump's executive orders, like passing the budget that they want to, because they can if they just decided to govern? I mean, some of these things are just so simple that it's like they are trying on purpose to not take the wins and the low-hanging fruit that's available to them.
Well, yeah, that's a fair observation. I mean, I certainly know Speaker Mike Johnson is not like Paul Ryan. He's not trying to get in the way of President Trump. Speaker Johnson is all the time talking about how he is trying to advance President Trump's agenda. You know, I pay attention to what's happening in Congress. And, you know, you were much closer to it than I ever was when you were working for the administration back in 2018, 2020. You know, if it was so simple, I would think they would do it. Why are they doing it is a good question. There are things that they have to do. You know, you've got 435, you know, members of the House who are up for reelection next year. Passing legislation is not a simple thing. You've got all these committees. You've got to get legislation through. You've got to negotiate. Then you've got to deal with the Senate. I mean, the system was never designed to be very efficient. It was never designed to do as much as it's doing, but it was never designed to be very efficient. And, you know, the two houses are so different. You know, of course, in the Senate, you've got the filibuster, which is what we just witnessed and why we had the longest so-called government shutdown in history, because eight Democrats decided they were just going to filibuster. They weren't going to pass the continuing resolution, clean continuing resolution, which they then caved on and folded, which is good. But, you know, they could have just done that to begin with. You know, was it just an election ploy? Some people think it was to help elect two blue governors, one in New Jersey, one in Virginia. Who knows? I can't be so cynical. But, you know, Congress has work to do, and they're going to have to do it. Of course, you know, when the government shut down, they can't really do much. So now that the government's open, what are they going to do? You know, when you look at the polls, what do people care about most? People care about the economy. CBS poll over the last few days, 45% of people rank economy and inflation number one. Number two is health care. Number three is immigration and border security. And so when you look at those issues and what the American people care about, the Congress is going to have an opportunity coming up in the next session to negotiate six or seven funding bills, because what they've been doing since Biden is just passing continuing resolutions. Right? That's all they've done. They haven't actually appropriated money on policy. Now they're going to start doing that, I hope. That's what they should do. That's what Speaker Johnson says he wants to do. And Leader Scalise also, majority leader. So they're going to do education, lots to talk about there, commerce, labor, HHS, the Justice Department, transportation, interior, HUD. Those are the spending bills that are up next. And when you look at each one of those, there's a lot of interesting policy discussions in each one of those that will drive some of the discussion. You know, transportation. There's a big flap right now between Sean Duffy, Secretary of Transportation, and Gavin Newsom over these illegals who have been given driver's licenses contrary to law and even regulation, I think, and have resulted in a dozen or more people that we know of who have been killed because these people couldn't read signs. the decisions, to the point you made before about decisions coming out of Washington, D.C., these have life or death consequences. In that, and that's just one example across a half a dozen spending bills. HHS, you've got the CDC in there. So lots of policy discussions, I think, that we're going to be looking at a lot, and they're going to have a lot to do between now and January. Lots.
And yeah, and you know, and you seem a lot more, McDonnelly, a little more bright and shiny than I'm feeling this morning. In terms of saying, you know, there's a lot of things that they're going to focus on.
Because I know who's on the throne, Jenna.
Well, yes, and that's great. However, God does give us free will, and that doesn't mean that Congress is going to suddenly, you know, become this beacon of excellence. And so, well, yes, eternally our future is secure, and we know all of that. We still can be, and I think rightly should be, very frustrated with a lack of momentum on taking advantage of this moment, because you know, instead of having all of these policy conversations, like I'm frankly just tired of having all of these conversations. I want action. I want wins. I want things that I can point to say that's being sent to President Trump's desk, and seeing all of these members of Congress around him in photo ops daily saying, look at what we have repealed. You know, for the American people. I mean, there are so many laws on the books, like the FACE Act, that have targeted Christians and conservatives that easily, I mean, we don't need any more discussion on it. So this is where I think a lot of conservatives, though, are really rightly frustrated with Congress, where, you know, they have all these committees and they're like, oh, well, we need to talk and we need to, you know, go back and forth. No, like the time is now. You guys have had 4 years under Biden to get it together to day one have, you know, Trump sign over 200 executive orders. He was prepared. Now the Congress is not taking up that same mandate. And I think that's just incredibly frustrating. And there's really no excuse for that. I don't want to see another year of discussions about policymaking. We know good policy. We've known it for a while. We need actual action. And, you know, I just don't have the faith and confidence in Speaker Johnson and Scalise that you do. But, you know, tell me where I'm wrong.
Be careful.
On that.
Don't put words in my mouth. I mean, I put my faith in one person. Okay, I just am saying that I don't think Speaker Johnson is trying to frustrate President Trump's agenda. I think they want to pass it, but it is not easy in Congress. So, Jenna, I think we've had a conversation about this before. What causes frustration? Frustration is caused when your expectations are not met. That's in marriage, that's in friendship, that's with your kids, that's in government, right? And so we can be frustrated, but let's make sure that we understand, what are we expecting? Are we expecting the right things? And you're expecting action from Congress. I'm not saying you're wrong to want action from Congress, and I don't want to make excuses for Congress, because I'm a man of action, and I want to see action as well, and all the things that you have talked about here are things that should be done. So I think what you need to do is make a phone call to Speaker Johnson, get him on your show and ask him, why aren't you doing this?
And we've tried.
He can explain it to you better.
We've tried, and he as you know, Mike, has been a friend of mine personally for years. Suddenly he's dodging all of the shows that will ask him those hard questions, and you wonder why, right? Because I'm a fan of Speaker Johnson. I think he's an amazing man of God in his personal life. I respect him, all of that. That doesn't mean that his leadership right now is being as effective as hopefully it could be. And I think that you are right that disappointment and frustration comes from expectations that aren't fulfilled. And that was the expectation after a phenomenal win. And I don't think I'm alone in this, that with the overwhelming win and the Trump mandate that everybody came into this year, we came in with expectations that Congress and Republicans under a Trump 2.0 would finally want to govern and would finally say, you know what, we don't care what the Democrats are going to do there in the minority. We want to actually get this done. And you see pockets of this, like with Secretary Hegseth. I think he's just like and also with Secretary Duffy. I think you're seeing that with what ICE is doing. I think you're even seeing that with what President Trump himself is trying to do. But Congress has been the same stagnant, same old, that it's like they can't get out of their own way to suddenly recognize the gift that they've been given in this moment. And I'm not sure that anything, I mean, because I know that Trump is even yelling at him. And he's saying, you know, get it together and you guys need to, he was frustrated. He wanted them to get rid of the filibuster to pass their own budget. And I supported him in that because Democrats would have done the same thing. And Republicans need to take advantage of the moment. We've got to take a break here. And I'm going to keep Mike Donnelly on the line because we want to continue this conversation. And when we only have an hour, you know, we have to take a few breaks at least here and there. But I think that the point of actually articulating what our expectations were going into this year and then evaluating where we're at and then saying, okay, let's set up reasonable expectations. I mean, taking into account that Congress has basically done nothing. But what would be reasonable expectations? Well, I think we should talk about that when we come right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. We're living in a time when truth is under attack. Lies are easy to tell, easy to spread, and easy to believe. But truth? Truth is costly. And nowhere is the cost greater than for mothers in crisis. When a woman is told abortion is her only option, silence and lies surround her. But when she walks into a preborn network clinic, she's met with compassion, support, and the truth about the growing life inside her. That moment of truth happens through a free ultrasound, and it's a game changer. When a mother sees her baby and hears that heartbeat, it literally doubles the chance she will choose life. Preborn Network clinics are on the front lines, meeting women in their darkest hour, loving them, helping them choose life, and sharing the truth. Friend, this is not the time to be silent. It is the time for courage, for truth, and for life. Just $28 provides one ultrasound and the opportunity for a mother to see her baby to help her choose truth and choose life. Please donate today. Call #250 and say baby. That's #250 baby or give online at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and I'm speaking with my special guest this morning, Mike Donnelly, who is a lawyer, about the problem that we're facing with the next year before the midterms. And I think where we've kind of landed in this conversation is maybe a realistic look at what actually can get done if Congress decides to actually govern. And to say, okay, instead of just wasting time and running out the clock, which is what it felt like they were doing when the government was shut down, it was like, okay, well, you know, oh no, the government's shut down. What can we do about it except go on, you know, all of these these television channels and talk about how tragic it is that we can't do anything? Well, now that they can, not just the realistic expectation of what are they probably going to do, because I think the answer to that, quite frankly, is not much. But in terms of if we're setting up a realistic, maybe wish list of what we could encourage our members of Congress to do, continue to advocate for and push for, what do you think, Mike Donnelly, would actually be on that list in terms of, you know, maybe even a top five on the priority list from your perspective for Congress and for the Trump administration as well?
Well, Jenna, thank you, and good morning to everyone. Great to be with you, of course. And Jenna, I just want to go back to something you said, though, because, again, to me, I think we have to have realistic expectations, and I don't think it's realistic for us to expect Congress to act like President Trump. You said there's a Trump mandate, and yes, I believe that Donald Trump had a mandate for his policies and the things that he wanted to do as the executive branch. But I think we need to be very careful to not conflate a Trump mandate with a Republican Party mandate, okay? Trump is a unique politician, okay? And we have to be very careful not to impose that across the entire government. So I'm just going to say, you know, there was a leadership fight in the Congress. You know, just a few years ago, Kevin McCarthy was the leader. And then they had a fight, and now it's Mike Johnson, and he's only been speaker for a year-ish, okay? And so I just think we have to be realistic about the fact that there are 219 Republican votes and 214 Democrats votes. This is extremely close. So the and not all those Republicans are like us, like you and me. Okay. And so, you know, they're not with us on a lot of issues. So there's, it is a complicated matter to navigate legislatively on policy and finding the things where you do have a governing majority. Okay. And, or where you don't. Number one. Number two, we're also dealing with decades of, I'll say, cultural pollution and malaise. That is not a small thing to identify. You've identified a few key things, which is good, but we've got a national conversation that we're trying to have, and we need to continue to have it, about where should we be focusing that legislative energy. And if we lose the Congress in 26, we're just going to be dealing with impeachment hearings the whole time. Which, you know, we're going to keep the Senate for sure. And I think they're going to keep the House. So I think we've got another 2 years after 2026 to get some really big things done. And once in 26, I think the Republicans will have more, a larger majority, because you see what's happening around the country. The states are redistricting. And I think that net favors the Republicans. And it'll be a bigger majority. It'll be a clearer mandate for Republican policies. And I think then you're going to see a lot bolder legislative action. But going up to that, the Republicans need to focus on those things that the American people care about. So economy, taxes, you know, they did that in the One Big Beautiful Bill, you know, kept the hugest tax increase that ever would have hit this country off the books, got rid of the ACA subsidies, which the Democrats shut the government down over. They want to extend that. That's what this shutdown was about. Republicans said nope. They held strong. I think that was really good. So going into the end of the year and into next year, I listed the things that they've got to do. You know, what are they going to do? I don't know. I'm not that close to Congress, but education, there's a federal education tax credit. That's good. Keep that and make it easier for people to use. HHS, you know, let's put some real funding reform into these entities that, you know, back in the pandemic, we're doing crazy things. Let's reform those. Department of Justice, I mean, that needs to get cleaned out. So these funding bills are going to provide the opportunity for Congress to really look at the programs and the people and the policies and have a conversation about it. Transportation, I mentioned before. So I think those are the ones that I would focus on. And there's so many, though. It's real, you know, it defies talking about in a single conversation.
Well, and all of the, I think that's a good point in terms of, you know, the overall difficulty with the lack of a supermajority or, you know, a lack of Republicans coalescing. But I'm going to disagree on one part of this, which is that the Trump mandate.
You don't agree with everything I said?
Come on. I know. Shocker. usually I do. So, you know, this is a red letter day. But having this as the Trump mandate, I don't think was exclusively focused on the executive. And here's why, because the Trump mandate included things that necessarily had to be done legislatively. And I think the expectation for how wildly popular the Trump mandate is and how much he won the popular vote and how we retained, a very slim majority, but still heading into the first 2 years of Trump's second term, there was still an expectation from the people that Republicans would coalesce. And one of the things that Mike Johnson says all the time, and he said this before he became speaker, I think even more forcibly, was that Congress is a team sport. But you have to then, as the captain of the team, lead and coalesce toward a goal and not look at this as, you know, your team having 200 plus different positions. I mean, this is why Trump, but then especially the Republican leadership in Congress, needs to get everyone on board and whip them more effectively to say, listen, this is the mandate we've been given. And I'm not talking about things that, you know, are so nuanced or maybe, you know, so divisive, like having some, you know, really amazing abortion legislation on the federal level that would just be amazing, right? Like, that's stuff that, like, dreams are made of for conservatives like you and I. Like, that would be amazing. And if we had a supermajority, maybe we could get that passed. But I'm talking about just some really basic common sense things, like the economy, like passing a budget that actually reduces deficit spending, incorporates DOGE, has, you know, at least some funding for the priorities that matter, like closing the border. And, you know, actually some of these things that should be very basic Republican priorities that Congress really hasn't even taken up because they're all too concerned with, you know, infighting and bickering. And so that to me signals a lack of leadership. I mean, when you look at how much time over the last year, Mike, has been focused on the Epstein files, like, that's just ridiculous to me. Now, I get Thomas Massie's point, and I actually agree with him that Congress needs to just release everything, because I think that everything that has been released is basically everything that can be in terms of the court and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, and, you know, and the judges that are over this, ongoing investigations and so forth. But so much media capital has been focused on that instead of some of these just basic priorities that I think that's an expectation that we can be legitimately disappointed in, because I do not think that the Trump mandate was only for the executive. That covered an expectation that Republicans would not behave similarly in this trifecta as they did in Trump's first term.
Well, that's a fair point, Jenna, but I think you have to, you know, not forget about the One Big Beautiful Bill. That was huge. That was not an easy thing. To me, that was the codification of that mandate. Then they passed it in July, boom, August, September, shutdown. So I think you got to give them a chance. I think you've got to give them credit for the One Big Beautiful Bill, number one, and you got to give Mike Johnson a lot of credit for that, in my opinion, and the leadership in the Republican Party for sticking together. It was not easy. It was not a given that that was going to go through the way it did. And there were a lot of really, really powerful, important things in that bill. And the shutdown happened. So that's basically the whole legislative year. So I think that you see the One Big Beautiful Bill as the answer to your question about they didn't do anything. Well, they did that, and I think it was a pretty big thing. Maybe it did include some of the things that you wanted, and I'm sure there could have been things in there that they should have included. Number two, let's give them a chance now and see what they do, and just realize that, you know, leading 435 people, even if it's a team sport, everybody there has their own agenda, they have their own view, and they have their own vote, and it's a difficult job. And it was never intended to do the things it's doing. So I'm going to give Mike Johnson a lot of benefit of doubt here, and I'm going to just keep praying for him.
Well, I'm going to keep praying for him as well. I think that, you know, we've gone far enough to not quite be at the, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I think that that was leading into this year and the first couple of months and, you know, DOGE and some of that. And I think the One Big Beautiful Bill was, to an extent, helpful. I mean, that was a significant win. However, there was so much more that should have been in there in terms of deficit spending, you know, reductions, and in terms of all of the waste and the DOGE. I mean, when Elon Musk is saying that he's out because he recognizes that Congress isn't actually serious about this, that's a really significant moment, I think, in this entire trajectory. And it's not just because, you know, I think that there was some beef with how much he was expecting to be to have a voice in the administration and, you know, that kind of side and element of things. But in terms of having DOGE as a priority, and then we really didn't get much from that. I mean, that could have been a signature initiative that Trump could have done on the federal level if he had, if he really, really wanted to, like what Governor DeSantis, even with a pretty hostile legislature at times, that is his own Republican supermajority, by the way, he's gotten a lot done in the state of Florida anyway, because he will use the powers of the Florida state constitution where he can to then effectuate policy on the issues that he can. And I just don't see the Trump administration having, you know, that kind of savvy enough in terms of governing. And I think that Trump, because, you know, he's not a lawyer, he's not someone like a DeSantis that can actually look at this all of this for himself. He's really smart in a lot of ways, and I think he's done a lot on his own initiative. But a lot of his advisors aren't providing some of these opportunities that he might otherwise have. But, you know, all of that to say, I guess we will see how much the Congress actually gets done. But what should be our expectation for Congress? Because I don't see the same momentum heading into 2026 as we had heading into, you know, January 20th of this year, because people want more than, even if you say the One Big Beautiful Bill was a phenomenal win, which, you know, I don't think it was that big of a win. But even if you take that as one win, we really can't point to a whole lot else that Congress specifically has done. And so I think the momentum is not necessarily going to drive voter turnout as much as it did in 2024. Maybe, though, the concern about some of these crazy Democrats like Zoran Mamdani are going to drive voter turnout. But, you know, why are you as confident that Republicans will retain the House and the Senate? Because I think that's a significant concern.
I think people realize, first of all, people give Republicans a plus five to plus 10 on the issues that are most important to them. So I think that when, and with redistricting, with the states actually getting their maps to reflect their actual electoral makeup, which is happening in a number of different places. Of course, you know, Gavin Newsom is trying to do it in the opposite direction in California, but, you know, that's what he expects. I think what you're going to see Congress do is the Congress is going to do regular order. They're going to pass individual spending bills. They're going to have debates over these individual spending bills. And I think these debates are going to show the difference between Republican policy and Democrat policy. And I think the Republicans win that debate to the extent that the American people are paying attention. And I think you have to count the One Big Beautiful Bill as a win, which is going to bear fruit next year with all the tax cuts and all of the policies that were implemented. And there were a lot in the One Big Beautiful Bill. We don't have time to go through them all. But, you know, as Congress goes through the education, commerce, labor, HHS, justice, transportation, interior, and HUD budgets over the next 2 months, because remember, the continuing resolution only goes until January 30th, and then we have another shutdown conversation, which the Democrats are already saying they're willing to shut the government down again. Okay, let's see. And then there are more challenging budgets coming later, energy, DHS, State Department, and Treasury with the IRS. So these budget bills are going to provide a landscape for us to have a conversation about policy and funding priorities, and that's going to give Congress the opportunity to cut more. Hopefully they'll do that or make changes to the way they fund certain programs. So I think that favors the Republicans. That's just my view, but I appreciate where you're coming from on that. And just a point on Elon, love the guy, incredible visionary. He had to leave because the law requires him to leave after 135 days as a special government employee, number one. And number two, as much as I love the guy, he predicted $2 trillion in spending cuts, and he didn't come anywhere near close to it. So I love the Doge. I thought it was great. They should have kept on going with it, and I hope they will keep on going with it. But I want to be careful not to over put too much on that.
Well, and yeah, and I mean, I would have loved $2 trillion worth of spending cuts. I think that would have been great. But I think that was a little bit of an unreasonable expectation. But if we had gotten even anywhere, you know, remotely close to that or even further, that we could say we've made some, you know, great strides in that, I just think that would have been helpful to the overall Republican cause. But great conversation, Mike Donnelly. This is why I always love having you on the program. I think the overall message here, folks, is that we need to continue to pray for our leaders, pray for those who are in positions of authority, and pray that they actually would want to govern with the tools that are available so that we are not consistently frustrated with government. We'll be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, let's end this morning on some good news, because tis the season, and this is the National Collection Week that is happening now through November 24th for Operation Christmas Child. This is an organization through Samaritan's Purse that uses a simple shoebox gift as an opportunity to share the love and hope of Jesus Christ. And since 1993, over 232 million shoebox gifts have been collected for children in over 170 countries and territories. And anyone can pack a shoebox, from individuals, families, churches. I know my home church in Colorado, my former home church, my home church here in Florida. We participate in this. It's a really an amazing opportunity for families, students, groups. And packing a shoebox is a great way to teach kids about thankfulness and giving back to those in need. So Elena Nicholson, who is with Operation Christmas Child, was just 8 years old when she has an incredible story at a time when she was feeling unloved, was handed an Operation Christmas Child shoebox gift, and was the first gift she ever received. So, Elena, good morning, and tell listeners a little more about your story and the impact of Operation Christmas Child.
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me today. So I grew up in a former Soviet Union with my sister Yulia, and where we grew up, it was a very small town in a very broken house, in the sense of we didn't have any food to eat. My parents would go off and they would work all day long, but they would never get paid with food or money. They would actually get paid with alcohol. So every night when they would come home, you could kind of feel the darkness coming over our house, because what that meant was, after a day of work and a day of drinking, my parents were coming home, and my dad was completely wasted, and so he became very abusive. And so by the age of 8, my parents were caught stealing some items, and so they were put into prison, and myself and my sister, we were put into our first orphanage. And truthfully, being at this first orphanage was basically a safe haven, in the sense that they provided us with, you know, food to eat. They had caregivers there 24/7 to try to, you know, make us behave very well. And the third thing was just the fact that they allowed us to go to school. And we stayed at this orphanage for about 2 years. And then after those 2 years, we were moved to our second orphanage. And in the second orphanage is where we actually received the shoeboxes. And so when we had the chance to go to the second orphanage, you know, we had the food, we had the caregivers, we had a school, but the things that we did not have the love. The caregivers were there to work, but then they had to go to their own homes. They had to go to their own families. We didn't have any toys to play with. And so I love the fact that we get to pack these shoeboxes with all of these fun items, because growing up, the only things I remember playing with was basically whatever we could find in the nature, like rocks, sticks, and flowers, basically. And there was no joy as well at this orphanage. And so when I was probably between 10 to 12, I had the chance to receive a shoebox. And for me and my sister, just receiving a small shoebox, that was a miracle in itself, because until that point, we have never received a gift before. And so when I actually hold the shoebox in my hand, it was an amazing thing, in the sense that it was wrapped in a colorful wrapping paper. It was bright. It was shiny. It was like the coolest thing that I have ever seen, so much so that I was actually afraid to open my box, because I thought the inside of it could not measure up to the way that I looked on the outside with the wrapping paper and everything. And the second thing was, I wanted my sister to have the best that she could have. And so my logic was, if she doesn't like her shoebox, she could have mine. And so when my sister opened her shoebox, she was in love with it, because everything in her shoebox was artistically related of a girl of her age, which is fantastic. And so when I was watching my sister, you know, pulling one item after another out of her shoebox, her smile just grew bigger and bigger and bigger. And so I had the courage to open my box. And when I opened my box was literally glowing pink from the inside out. And the cool thing about it is the fact that I love color pink. But the coolest thing about it is just the fact that God knew that about me, and he gave me a shoebox of color pink. And I had some socks in my shoebox that were fantastic, you know, warm for an orphanage, cold night. I had a teddy bear. I had an actual Barbie with a pink sparkly dress, and she was beautiful. One of my favorite things I got in my shoebox was a pink pen. And it was fascinating, because this pink pen had a fluffy on top and a wire and a heart that would jingle on it. And I'd never seen something like that before. And so I was fascinated with it, just going ding dong for like 5 seconds until I got to a point where I was like, I wonder if the ink on my pen is pink as well. And so as a child, just pressing down on that pen just to see the color of my ink, and the heart of the pen lit up and I went ballistic and I was like, guys, drop everything and look at my pen. I was the most popular kid for like 5 minutes at this orphanage because of a pen. But looking back now, when the heart of that pen lit up, my heart lit up for the first time, because in reality, by that point, between the age of 10 to 12, I felt like I was unloved. I felt like I was a nobody. I was just there taking up space. And so when I received a shoebox with my favorite items in it, I felt like I was being loved by someone that I've never even met, but they took up the time, they packed a box for me of my favorite things. And that feeling of that love and acceptance from a stranger, that was an amazing feeling in itself. But the coolest thing actually came out outside of my shoebox, and that is the little booklet that comes with the shoeboxes that we get to send, and it's called The Greatest Gift Booklet, and it's stories about Jesus, how he came and died for our sins. And being in an orphanage and reading that booklet, that was the first time I have heard or read about Jesus. And so when I read it, I thought it was the biggest fairy tale I have ever read. But because I had nothing to hold on to or nothing to hope for as an orphan girl, by the age of 18, I would have been kicked out. And there was no hope for me to survive after that. And so with no other hope to hold on to, that booklet became that hope. And so I started to pray, and I was like hoping that there was someone out there who was bigger than I am, who was in control. And I prayed for a family that would want me and my sisters together, because we were kind of a package deal. And in 2004, he provided that family. And so now I get to be in America since 2004, and my sister and I got adopted at the same time. And I am very, very blessed by God using a small pink shoebox and changing my life. So.
What an amazing story. And, you know, I'm just moved to tears, Alina, because my own little brother is adopted from Ukraine, and he's in our family now, and it's just one of the greatest blessings. And to hear you share your testimony and just your love for Christ and how he used that is truly incredible. So how would you encourage our listeners, if they want to get involved, to know what kinds of items and things to pack to be able to share that same love that you experienced? Because I think people in America kind of don't understand how amazing this kind of gift is for someone like you.
Absolutely. So a lot of information could be found on the website, SamaritansPurse.org/OCC. There's a few, you know, do's and don'ts of putting the stuff in the shoebox. Like, you don't want to put a liquid in it because it could destroy the whole shoebox. But my favorite things are like the things that I would encourage people to pack is just something bright and fluffy. Like, I like to put stuffed animals in my shoebox, even for like 10 to 14 year olds, just because I know sometimes we get into that set of American mindset, you know, and we're like thinking, well, our kids wouldn't like 10 to 14, they wouldn't like a teddy bear in their gift. But these kids, I mean, they have to grow up so fast in their real life. So when they get a shoebox and they get a teddy bear in that shoebox and they get to hold it, and for that 5 minutes, they could feel like they are a kid again. They don't have to take care of their families or, you know, their brothers or sisters or whatever it might be. But that was just a thing that I would encourage someone to just not think of it as an American mindset, but, you know, just bright, fun items that we could think of putting in the shoebox. But first of all, I would encourage everybody to pray when they pack. God tends to lead us to the right things that he wants us to pack in these shoeboxes. Like my sister and I mean, we're different people, but she's got what she would have liked, you know, all artistic things. And I got what I all liked, and that's only because God made it that way.
Yes, and I so sense. Absolutely. And so be praying for those of us who are going to participate in this. And I would encourage you to do that. Be praying over the children who are receiving these mm-hmm. gifts and for the packing of these items, and that the stories would be similar, that the booklet that comes with this would be read by the children and would lead them into a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ, because that's the ultimate priority. So join us in National Collection Week happening now through November 24th. Go to SamaritansPurse.org/OCC, SamaritansPurse.org/OCC. And Elena, thank you so much for sharing your story. And again, for everyone who wants to be involved, please take advantage of the season to make a difference in the life of a child, possibly for eternity. SamaritansPurse.org/OCC. You can reach me and my team, Jenna@AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.